Welcome back to Financial Therapy. It's not just about the money. I'm personal financial planner, columnist, and financial therapist, Rick Kaler. Research tells us that 90% of all financial decisions are made emotionally, not logically. For nearly four decades, I've been helping people make better money decisions. So what makes my financial worldview different from most financial experts? I blend the nuts and bolts of financial advice with the emotions that drive making them. Good money decisions are not just about the money. So let's get started with today's episode. Welcome back to another edition. I wanted to talk about something today that I have never written a column on that I could find. And I've been writing columns since, 1991? And certainly I haven't talked about on a podcast. And this is income inequality, wealth inequality. And typically, when you hear references to income and wealth inequality, they usually focus on how unevenly income and wealth are distributed throughout a population. And the findings or the issue is that the greater the gap between those at the top and those at the bottom, the more problematic it can be to the social health of a country. Now, of course, if you have no gaps, that's problematic too, because I think that's called socialism. So you're looking for some health here. Now, am I going to talk about income inequality as it pertains to any country or the United States? No. What I'm going to talk about is in a marriage or a committed relationship, income and wealth inequality between the partners also presents some challenges that don't exist where the partners are financially equal. So we're talking about something a little bit different here, but it still has some poignant ramifications to the relationship. I think we all can agree that typically money isn't talked about a lot in the early stages of a dating relationship. I mean, it's just not the thing that romance and date night are built on. And you could see this dynamic on all sorts of the popular dating shows like ABC's The Bachelor and The Bachelorette. And I think they also have Bachelor in Paradise. Netflix has a real popular show called Love is Blind. I'm working on co-authoring a book with Deb Kaplan. And in that, she brings out that there's three stages. Now, the book is on financial therapy for couples, kind of a do-it-yourself book. And the three stages of dating are first lust, which is the sex drive or libido, attraction, which are those early stages of intense romantic love. And then the third is attachment, which are deep feelings of connection to a long-term partner. So it could be that money might be more talked about in the attachment phase, but doesn't mean that it is, right? Many, many people get into long-term committed relationships or marriages without talking about money at all. So I came across a show because I've been doing research on couples, you know, partly for this book. And there was one reality show I came across called Marrying Millions on Hulu. And it's kind of an annoying thing because I think you pay $7 a month with ads and $15 a month without or something. I would recommend the without, but my frugality hasn't allowed me to do that yet. So this particular program specifically deals with the income and wealth inequality of couples. And it's usually really stark, like somebody with nothing and somebody with tens of millions or hundreds of millions. And the interesting thing is that most of the couples that are featured there have been together for a minimum of 6 months to, I think the maximum was 8 years. So I would say they're typically beyond the attraction stage and starting to deal with the attachment stage of the relationship. And the reality of the income and wealth inequality and what that brings into the relationship. The other thing that I've noticed, and I think this makes a lot of sense, and this isn't always case, but income equality is often accompanied by an age discrepancy. And I think that makes sense because typically the older a person is, more years they've had to accumulate wealth. And while it's probably a little bit more normal for the male to be older and have accumulated, that's not always the case at all. And there's a number of cases where it's the woman that has been the more successful. Most cases would be a little bit older than the man, but not in every case. Not in every case. So I don't think you can go with a rule of thumb there. The interesting thing in watching these couples and the couples that I've encountered in my financial planning practice and financial therapy practice is not all income and wealth inequalities produce the same outcomes. So what am I talking about? Here's the three categories of the dynamics that I most often see. And I've never read about these anywhere. These are just kind of my observations, so I'd be interested in any feedback that any of you have. The first one I call the funder and beneficiary. This is where the wealthy partner completely supports the poorer partner, basically paying for everything. While this tends to be the stereotypical perception of unequal relationships, in my experience, this is the least likely. The second one I'll call the proportional spenders. This is where the wealthy partner often pays for the couple's social life, entertainment, travel, while the basic living expenses for the poorer partner, like mortgages, utilities, are proportionately divided, or if they're not living together, the proportional spender doesn't support. And the third would be the equal dividers. Here the partners agree, sometimes at the insistence of one or the other, that each of them pays an equal share of all joint expenses, whether they're living together or dating, traveling, etc. Now, each of these dynamics comes with its own variations, and I'll get into those here in a couple of minutes. But what's most interesting to me, and I want to see how this lands with you, what I have observed is the greatest stress and pressure often doesn't come from the couple's response to the financial inequality. I'm not saying there is none. I'm saying the greatest stress seems to come from what I've called in the past WWPT. What will people think? And in this case, people frequently means friends and family who may not be exactly mute about their concerns, disapproval, advice, shock, and a number of things. And it's interesting because often the family and friends of the wealthier partner will express concern that the non-wealthy partner is using them and is a gold digger, only interested in them for their money. That's almost always where the thoughts go of friends, family, business associates, etc. Now, that could absolutely be true, but it could absolutely be false. And it can also be true that the wealthy partner is even aware in that case that they are, quote, being used by a, quote, gold digger, that they're aware of that and okay with it. So there's a lot of combinations here to consider, like so many things, black and white, often doesn't fit well. Conversely, in this case, the family and friends of the non-wealthy partner often express their suspicion that they are being used by the wealthy person, especially if the non-wealthy partner is younger, which is true more than it's not. And again, this can be totally true, just as it can be false or true with both partners' awareness and acceptance. So this is my big takeaway of the podcast, is that the pressure comes from without. I mean, there's additional issues in socially combining the partner's family and friends, right? You're bringing together these two groups. And when doing that, money scripts and financial comfort zones around the rich and the poor, on the part of both, each partner will have their money scripts on the rich and the poor. But then you've got all their family and friends that have their money scripts on the rich and the poor. And when you start combining all this, this really can make for challenging interactions that can range from awkward to absolutely relationship ending. When I've taken courses on couples therapy, they somewhere in the course will always remind you that when there's a couple in the room, there's not two people in the room. They're all of their friends and family and ancestors and business partners. The room is super crowded when you get two people together. And so this is what we're talking about with these financially unequally matched couples. So as a result of all this, the pressures exerted by the people not in the room, well, they are in the room, you know, when they're talking with them, by the family and the friends and the business partners, can actually end up being one of the greatest challenges, if not the greatest challenge, for financially unequal couples. So I find that typically it's going to take above average determination, introspection, emotional intelligence, and transparent communication for a couple to overcome the challenges of financial inequality. Now, the good news to this is that the inequality almost always forces the couple to have the money talk relatively early in the relationship. And that's one of the big differences, you know, in viewing these programs. If you view the Marrying Millions, money's being talked about. I mean, that's the focus, right? And so that in itself can result in a better chance of a relationship succeeding. So just a minute ago, I described the three common dynamics in couples, where one partner is wealthier than the other. The founder and beneficiary, right? Where the wealthy partner pays for everything, the professional spenders who contribute based on their income, and the equal dividers who split the expenses down the middle. So let's explore the emotions going on for the partners in these relationships. So first, the funder and beneficiary. Here, the wealthy funder often has a love language of giving and may have money scripts that giving makes them more attractive, that they're not going to attract someone unless they give. There's often a really wounded part of themselves, hungry for belonging, that attempts to satisfy that need by attracting a partner through showing love materialistically. On the other hand, the non-wealthy beneficiary, so to speak, of this may have a focus on the financial benefits of dating the wealthy partner, right? So they are often more compliant and tolerant in the relationship in exchange for monetary benefits, and they could be unwilling to rock the boat if the partnership doesn't progress to a long-term commitment. But not always, not always. So the beneficiary of the funder typically has a vulnerable part of themselves desperate for belonging, who's come to believe that material gifts and support are outward evidence of someone's affection. So a reduction in material expression from the funder can trigger that vulnerable part of them that feels unwanted, that now they're not wanted anymore. So it can get pretty complex, but you can see in this case where if you have two people whose love language is materialism, how they can be a perfect fit for one another. And of course, without those wounded parts of themselves getting attention resolved in their extreme beliefs, things can eventually go south in the relationship. We could go on and on with that, but let's move on to the proportional spenders, or I'll run out of time. So the wealthier proportional spender can be the more balanced of the three wealthy personalities, right? So while they recognize the inequality, they're willing to spend proportionately. They don't fully financially support their partner, but you can see them being okay with, you know, paying for the travel or paying for the date, or even coming up with an arrangement where we split things 75-25 or something of that sort. Typically, though, when it comes to living expenses and things like that, they may not be supporting the partner that way. Or if they're living together, it again can be proportional to the income. The non-wealthy proportional spender is also possibly the more balanced of the three types of non-wealthy. They tend to accept the partner's higher contribution. Maybe they'll even accept some financial support, but they're not going to do this in exchange for settling. They're typically willing to lose the relationship and all of its perks if there's no perceived future. And they certainly have a vulnerable part of themselves that needs to belong. But it isn't overly focused on love being expressed materially, which would be, you know, this is true of both of these personalities. They've got a pretty good sense of being responsible for themselves financially, are generally okay with the inequality, and are also okay receiving. And then we go to the equal dividers. Now, in this case, the wealthier partner is often pretty vigilant. So the money scripts here are usually money vigilant money scripts around their spending. And that is probably also true with the non-wealthy partner. They can often have a vulnerable part that longs for belonging and attachment, but fears that affection shown by a partner is going to be tainted by their money, by what they have, what they're bringing to the table net worth-wise, instead of being authentic. So this particular type can really fear being played for their money. So they have a huge fear with only being valued for their money. So they put in stringent boundaries to protect themselves, which sometimes can be a little overkill. The non-wealthy equal divider, in the same fashion, insists on paying their own way, puts up stringent boundaries around receiving, right? So while they might occasionally accept the wealthy partner paying for a date night or some of a trip, they pretty much pay their share of lifestyle expenses and travel. Now, this can cause problems when they're splitting the bill in half. The wealthy partner can easily afford it, but it may be a huge stretch for the non-wealthy partner and actually cause them some real financial issues because they're paying for half of it, but they can't afford it. Sometimes, though, if they can't afford it, they'll say so, which is a real clean response, and modify the activity to something less expensive. So, no, I can't afford to go on to that trip. Of course, you can get blending of all three of these types where when one is drawing the boundary there, the more wealthy might say, you know what, I'd be okay paying a little bit more. But again, if they are fully in this category, they're not going to want to pay anymore because that's a sign of being used. Also, the non-wealthy partner is also willing to lose the relationship and its perks if there's no perceived future. And I think that's also true of the wealthy partner who's willing to lose the relationship if their boundaries are not held to. So again, we probably have partners here that have vulnerable parts that feel inadequate, guilty, carry shame. They could have inner parts that are really critical for themselves, especially the non-wealthy one, for not having more and feel ashamed of not having more or being able to pay their own way. So there again, can be a lot of money scripts here. So I would say this person probably has a problem receiving. The non-wealthy person has a problem receiving from the wealthier. And the wealthier has a problem giving, right? So it's all very complex. And you can have personalities, partners that come from different places. Like you could have a wealthy person that's kind of in the funder and beneficiary category, and then a non-wealthy partner that's an equal divider. And that is probably a partnership that's not going to thrive, right? You have one wanting to pay for everything. You have one insisting, putting up these barriers and boundaries that everything is going to be split. So my whole point to this is that financial inequality, which I've just gone through those dynamics between the partners, usually the partners are going to work this out. Not always, but usually. Financial inequality is less important when both partners feel valued and respected for who they are, rather than the monetary value they bring into the relationship. They've had the talks. They've worked through this. I'm feeling shame because I can't pay. Well, I'm not feeling shame in paying for you. It feels very comfortable for me. And working these dynamics out, sometimes they don't work out. In other cases, they absolutely do work out. But where the real rub comes in the relationship is usually from without, from friends and family, from joining two completely different financial comfort zones together, and all of the forces that are applied to the couple from without. I've just seen way more problems caused by that than the actual inequality. So those are my thoughts. And by the time you have heard this podcast, these columns have ran. They were picked up by a couple of national publications and blogs. So I'll be interested in what you think, what others think, how accurate my perceptions are. Again, this is not based on research. So for those of you who listen to the podcast who are researchers, and I know you're out there, this would be a great dissertation. And I'm sure there's stuff done on this somewhere. I've just never seen a whole lot on it, especially with the focus of the pressures from without that are brought to bear by friends and family. So thanks again for listening. Please reach out to me at rick@rickkaler.com with any thoughts. And I do appreciate suggestions for future podcasts. I put those in a file. And I haven't run out of things yet. So take care, and I will look forward talking to you next time. Thanks for joining me, Rick Kaler, for another episode of Financial Therapy. It's not just about the money. This is where I combine the nuts and bolts of financial advice with the emotions that drive making them. Remember, every financial behavior, whether it appears illogical to you or others, makes perfect sense when we understand the underlying beliefs, feelings, and thoughts. Sign up for my weekly blog at financialawakenings.com. I hope you'll join me again for our next episode.